Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and with me now, Larry King, the legendary broadcaster who retired from his CNN show last fall. He has a new book called Truth Be Told, off the record about favorite guests, memorable moments, funniest jokes, and a half century of asking questions. So let's talk with Larry King about his life and times. 53 years of politics, media, and sports. And for our New York audience, maybe we'll also go back to his growing up in Brooklyn as Larry Zeiger. Larry, so nice of you to come in and do this. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you, Brian. It's good to be with Jim's youngest son.
No relation. No, really. People ask all the time. Only in spirit. You write that your first memory is of learning that your father died of a heart attack when you were 9 years old.
That would be, in fact, 68 years ago. It was a major turning point in my life. My family had they'd lost a boy before I was born who was 6 years old. He had a burst appendix, and I think I was born about a year later. And so my father and I were very close. I have a younger brother who, in fact, has no memory of my father. He was 6 and a half. I was 9 and a half, and I have a lot of memories of him. His voice, his comedic tones. He was an Austrian immigrant. And he loved America, boy. He loved America. And he wanted to, he tried to enlist, and they wouldn't take him because he was over 40. So he quit whatever he was doing and went to work in a defense plant in Kearney, New Jersey, building ships to help America. And he did the overnight shift, and he died on the bus going from the train station out to Kearney. And I was on a midnight, he was on a midnight shift, and I found about it.
But
found
instead
out about it Saturday morning.
But instead of going to the funeral, you stayed home and bounced a Spalding off the front step. Your mother let you do that?
Yeah, because she was in terrible shape. They were very devoted. She never remarried. She was only 40. And she didn't force me to go to the funeral. And I never cried. I was angry. And this is in retrospect. I didn't know what I was. 9 and a half is a very tough age to deal with death. In fact, James Agee wrote a play called A Death in the Family, or Dark at the Top of the Stairs, I think was another name for it as a film. 9 and a half is a very confusing age. Now maybe with the advanced educational ways we have in this country, the 9 and a half understands it better. But I didn't know it at all, so I took it as leaving me. And I felt deserted and alone. I got much closer to my mother after that. I began to overly worry about her. I even used his death, you know, pity me, I'm the boy without a father.
You wrote that you prayed in synagogue in a way to bring pity on yourself.
Correct. I was the youngest boy there. You had to say Kaddish twice a day.
The prayer for the dead.
Early in the morning and at night, and I would often fill the minyan. You needed 10 in the synagogue, and they'd all look at me with, oh, you had to be. Of course, you knew your father or mother died if you were saying Minhag Ma'ariv, I think that's what it was called. And they'd all look at me with great pity at this 9 and a half year old boy going here every morning.
Larry King with us, his new book called Truth Be Told. Where in Brooklyn was that stoop?
That stoop was on Hopkinson Avenue. In Brownsville. I was born at 208 Howard Avenue in Brownsville, and we moved to Hopkinson, and then soon after that, we moved to Bensonhurst. And so my growing up years, I consider Bensonhurst.
What was the neighborhood like then?
It was half-Jewish, half-Catholic, Italian. We didn't know what a Protestant was. I think John Lindsay was the first Protestant.
Or a black or a Latino or an Asian.
We had some blacks, no Latinos. We had some blacks who were either the sons of superintendents of buildings, but not many.
Was it rough? Do you think of it as a rough neighborhood in retrospect?
No. It was, in retrospect, a wonderful neighborhood. In fact, I take my boys, I have two young boys, and they're enamored of the Dodgers and of my stories of Brooklyn. I take them to where Ebbets Field was, and I take them to the house I grew up in, which is still intact, and they always remark, gee, with nice trees, and It's a pretty neighborhood, Bay Parkway. Sandy Koufax were up there, Freddie Wilpon. We all went to Lafayette High School, which is an excellent school.
You didn't lose money with Madoff like them, did you?
I did.
You did?
I lost, I write about it in the book, I lost Freddie Wilpon, who's a great guy and a dear friend, and he's having his problems now, but I just saw him last week. I wish him nothing but the best. Freddie got me in. In fact, Madoff was, he turned down my brother. He turned down a lot of people. And I never met him, nor did I ever speak to him. We're trying to get him to do a special with him. We've contacted the prison. We've contacted him. And so Freddie got me in with him because Freddie told me that this guy just is incredible.
Why would he turn down your brother but take you if he was doing a scam?
Because he turned down a lot of people, and which was part of the scam. It made him attractive. There's a lady in West Palm Beach, a very wealthy lady, who chased him for years, begging him to take her money, and he turned her down. So naturally, she would tell others. Some of those others he would take.
Helps to keep his cover.
And what happened with me and Madoff, the money was funneled through to him, and he every month we'd get a statement. I never saw this. I have accountants in Boston who saw this. He never lost. Sometimes he'd go up at 1%, sometimes 8%, sometimes 11%. At the end of the year, we'd be up 17%. Some months he would not buy any stocks. He would tell us he bought treasuries. It was a bad month. He, in fact, never bought a treasury, never bought a stock. We would get statements. And over the years, this is a true story, over the years, we gave him, I think, $4.8 million, and we took out $4.1 million. So we were down $700,000, although we made some money in that time. I thought we may have made some money. Anyway, we were down. The books
don't,
read.
Be seven. Careful. Irving Picard will come
no,
after
Irving
you.
No, Irving Picard sent us a check for $200,000, and the federal government gave us back $500,000, which is the max they give back on Madoff things. Because we had paid taxes on stock we didn't have, so we were paying, we paid $500,000 in taxes that on stock we never, had a share of stock.
Larry King, his new book, Truth Be Told. How long has it been since you lived in New York? Was it just when you were 18, that's it, you were gone?
No. I did a bunch of odd jobs and left the year I broke into radio, 1957. I left here in, I guess, March, and I got hired in April, and I stayed with my uncle down in Miami Beach, and I started in radio. You never forget that either. May 1st, 1957.
So is there a part of you that is still very much a New Yorker?
Very much. I left Brooklyn, but Brooklyn never left me.
In what way?
I still feel a part of it. I'm so happy about the resurgence of the borough. Williamsburg is now in. I'm happy for the people who live here. I think Brooklyn was a special place and is a special place. We always felt we were on an island. I never said the word Manhattan. We said we're going into the city. In other words, Brooklyn wasn't in the city.
People
we were
still
going,
do that.
We were going into the city. We went to Madison Square Garden, went to Dodger games. We lived a full life. We had a club called the Warriors. I guess there were 21 of us, about, I guess, 15 were Jewish, 6 were Italian. We played basketball. We played softball. We were in the Jewish Community House at 79th Street in Bay Parkway. I visited there. I take my boys there. So the culture of Brooklyn, I never lost. Nobody got divorced. Nobody moved. In fact, it's a true story. I was talking to Wilpon about this. I could meet someone I haven't seen in 40 years, and the time disappears. And in 20 minutes, we're talking about the old times.
If they were from that neighborhood.
If they were from there.
Let's talk about the media. You write that your first real media hero when you were still a kid in Brooklyn was Mike Wallace. That was well before 60 Minutes, right?
Oh, well before. Nightcap.
Nightbeat, was that the name of the show?
Yeah, Nightbeat. Nightcap was another show. Nightbeat was the name of the show. I watched it religiously. I would run home to watch it.
How do you explain Chris Wallace, his son, being the face of Fox News Sunday? Youthful rebellion, generational rebellion against his father?
They're very close. They love each other. Chris is very different than Mike. There'll never be another Mike Wallace. Chris is a very good reporter, very good newsman. Mike was a little saddened that he never got considered really a journalist. He was more the performing end of journalism, even though he anchored news in Los Angeles. He did a show with his ex-wife. He anchored news here. He was part of CBS's election coverage every year, sitting around with Cronkite.
60 Minutes, equals broadcast journalism.
But he was always, because 60 Minutes was advocate journalism.
True.
60 Minutes took a stand.
Correct.
And all of their pieces, you knew they were going with, and they did gotcha journalism long before Sarah Palin. They ran up, Mike Wallace ran up on the street up to a garage, turning back the odometer. They'd confront the guy. Technically, they had no power. All he had to do was say goodbye.
But Chris, that liberal father of mine, nothing like that?
No. In fact, truth be known, Mike Wallace is a Republican and was offered by Richard Nixon the job of press secretary, which he turned down because he didn't want to be part of government. Mike, I would call a liberal Republican. And Chris works at Fox. But I think Chris is one of the few, if only there, that I would call objective journalist.
Larry King, his memoir, Truth Be Told. And you write in the book about cable TV in general and the competitive environment that you were in, especially in the last years. And you agree in the book with Jon Stewart that Fox News Channel is not a network, it's a political party. That's the Stewart quote. And you expand it to say MSNBC is also a political party. Do you think that's good, bad, or neutral?
The era of journalism I grew up in calls it bad. I think we were better served in the Murrow, Huntley, Brinkley, that era of journalism when CBS was the crowning jewel, and if an event happened, you turned to CBS. I think CNN now has that mantle. I think if a tragedy occurs, God forbid, right this minute, people will turn to CNN, and the CNN does very well. It does not do as well when things are just things, and then the Republican Party or the Democratic Party takes over. I think Roger Ailes is a kind of a genius.
Head of Fox.
And I think what Fox does, they do very well. And what MSNBC does, they do very well. But they are not objective journalists, in my opinion. When they say the fairness or that's a lot of baloney. It's not there. If you're Republican, you're okay. And if you're Democrat, you're not. And it's vice versa on the other one. So I don't watch either.
You have an opinion. So you have no opinion about Rachel Maddow or Keith Olbermann, equivalent of Hannity and O'Reilly to you, or somehow different?
Different in a sense. I tend more toward probably, although I never give it on the air, I tend more toward the liberal. I think Keith Olbermann is the best writer on television in any form. He is a genius. Whether you agree or disagree, no one writes better. Rachel Maddow is very good at what she does. Sean Hannity is good at what he does, except he gives no allowance for the other side. And Sean has been very nice to me, and I was on his show, and he was really kind of sweet to me. And so I like him as a person. But his journalism, if you can call it that, is so biased as to almost be, I don't use the word ridiculous. He just like, I tuned in the other day and I couldn't watch it more. I forget what he was on. But whatever he was on, the person was guilty. And he was obviously guilty. I believed in innocent until proven guilty. A lot of them don't. O'Reilly's very good at what he does. You know, and O'Reilly, the guest, is a prop. And it's a prop for his views. Does it well.
Your Wikipedia page says, unlike many interviewers, King has a direct, non-confrontational approach. His reputation for asking easy, open-ended questions has made him attractive to important figures who want to state their position while avoiding being challenged on contentious topics. You accept that description?
Do not. In fact, every time I get that, I've always asked the person saying it, give me an example. Never heard an example. What I try to do all my career was ask good questions, listen to the answers, and follow up. I believe, without boasting, I made the front page of the New York Times more than any other talk show host ever. That comes from asking good questions. Most people think that by being contentious, when you're contentious, when that's your, all right, but let's put it this way. I never had an agenda. I never went on the air to get someone or not get someone. I went on the air to learn. I was a conduit. I never went on the air saying I'm there to get you, nor was I there not to get you. I was just there to ask good questions. In that time, I learned and developed. Ross Perot twice said he wasn't running for president. In the same hour, I got him to announce. I didn't do it by saying, "You're kidding me." The worst question you could ask, if you were doing an interview with Osama bin Laden, the worst first question, which would be asked by many, "Why did you bomb those buildings?" And then he's defensive and it's an argument. It may be attractive television. I didn't learn anything. I think my first question would have been, why did you leave the richest family in Saudi Arabia? And then I try to find out where his anger came from so that later in the interview we learn why he did. See, what we're trying to do is learn why. And in the contentious shows, we never learn why. We learn that, but we don't learn why. I always was a why person. And I let myself out of it. I never used the word I.
We're going to take a quick break, and when we continue, we'll return with Larry King, Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with Larry King, and let's take a phone call. It's Dion in Commerce, Texas. You're on WNYC in New York with Larry King. Hello.
Hello, Brian. Hello, Larry.
Hi.
Don't know if you want to live in the past. I don't, but you gave me lots of great memories when you were on the Mutual Network.
Those were great days.
Yes, it was. You always had an annual show, Why Are You Up Night Tonight, and you're the only one I've ever known that's done that. It always brought out a broad cross-section of people, from what I recall.
Sure did.
It was always an interesting night. Why won't others emulate you? Is it just because you did it first and no one else wants to follow you?
I don't know. I don't know. I don't know if Jim Bohannon does it. He does the all-night show now. But I always found it fascinating to do a poll on the air, because you always hear polls and they tell you this and tell you that. And we found out a lot of interesting things all night. The number one listener, at least those that called when they would call, and we did it once a year, were college students, graduate students up studying. High on the list were pilots, medical school, hospitals. I was the commencement speaker at Columbia University Medical School. In their graduating class in 1987, and it was voted on by the students, because all of whom listened to me. I knew that from polling.
We joke on this show sometimes about the 10 a.m. to noon audience being the unemployed, the retired, night shift workers, stay-at-home parents, and anybody who's homesick.
Well, people in cars.
And, of course, people in cars. People working, driving, always, at any time. But, you know, and it's not even true anymore in the podcast era. You never know who's listening. And
correct.
The show's on nationally, on satellite radio, so I mean, you never know.
Just to Commerce, Texas.
Right? There you go. I read, though, that on that Mutual overnight show, you would have a guest for 3 hours.
Correct.
90 minutes of you interviewing the person, followed by 90 minutes of calls.
And then 2 hours of open phones. It was a five-hour show.
Who would come on for 3 hours in the middle of the night?
Al Gore, Bill Cosby, Danny Kaye, Marvin Hamlisch, Bill Clinton called in. It was an amazing show.
The CNN show started.
Authors.
Sorry?
A lot of authors.
CNN show started in 85.
Correct.
And for a while you did the 9 o'clock Eastern CNN show, followed by overnight radio.
10 years.
How could one person do that?
I always had stamina. Still do. I cannot explain why I only need 5 hours of sleep, and why I certainly can nap a little.
Do you do stand-up now?
Yeah. But it's stories. I don't just do patter jokes. I tell stories of things that happened to me as a child, things that happened to me in broadcasting. They're all funny. I've been doing them for years at conventions, But my nephew heads a huge production company that produces theater, Broadway shows. They did the producers, in fact, Base Entertainment. And he said, why don't you do a comedy tour? And so they booked me, and I worked so far Boston, Indianapolis, Atlantic City. I'm going to Europe. I'm going to Australia, Hong Kong. They know me everywhere. And in the countries where there's a sizable amount of English-speaking people, I go and I tell my stories. It's a great way to make money because, as Norm, the great general, told me,
Schwarzkopf.
Speaking and doing funny things in front of an audience is white-collar crime.
You're taking money for something
that you love.
Frank in Howard Beach, you're on WNYC with Larry King. Hello.
Yeah, good morning, Mr. King.
Hi.
Thanks for being one of a long list of greats and all professions that came from Brooklyn.
Hey, oh, yeah, you're not kidding.
I'm sure you probably mentioned that in your book.
I sure do in many
Eddie
books.
Eddie Kay, Shelley Winters, great doctors.
I wrote a book once, which was my personal favorite, called When You're From Brooklyn, Everything Else is Tokyo. And in which I discussed, I don't know what it is, maybe it's in the water, but there's something about Brooklyn.
But what I wanted to ask you, growing up in Brooklyn in the 40s and 50s, do you have recollections like on a warm summer night where the Brooklyn Dodgers were on radio and walking down the block and every stoop had a radio on and you wouldn't miss a beat in the play-by-play?
Red Barber was a distinctive part of my childhood.
Yeah.
One of the reasons I wanted to be a broadcaster was Red Barber, Arthur Godfrey, and that crew. Red Barber, Vince Scully learned at his knee, and Vince Scully has been the Dodger announcer now for 60 years.
Yeah.
Vin is 83, 84. Red Barber was in our soul. He taught me baseball. When I went to my first baseball game, which was right after my father died, I knew that field. Because Red Barber taught me that field. There has never been a broadcaster like him in baseball. Yes, that's part of Brooklyn.
Peter in Hillside, New Jersey, are on WNYC with Larry King. Hi, Peter.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. My question for Larry is, after the O.J. Simpson acquittal, when he came on his show, he called him Juice. I was wondering why he did that, but I also want to say Larry King is the best journalist or somebody I have ever seen before, because even during that time, I remember they were mad about O.J. Simpson. He asked them, don't you want to really know whom the real killer is, even if it's not O.J. Simpson? So I must commend him the way he asked his questions, but I want an answer off the air. Thank you.
Thank you, Peter.
Okay, sure.
Because
I called.
Why do you call him Juice as if he was a friend?
Because everybody called him Juice. If you lived in L.A., you knew O.J. I knew O.J. And I spent some time with him. When he worked at NBC, I would go up sometimes and watch them do their broadcasts. I interviewed him. I used to do Dolphin football. I did the color for the Dolphins. I must have interviewed him twice each season when he played with Buffalo. And everyone called him Juice. His name was O.J. Simpson, like orange juice. And we all called him Juice. I wouldn't be surprised if the prosecutor in an idle moment called him Juice. And the reason I asked him that question, which was a very good question, the day after his acquittal, is he going to continue the quest for the killer? After all, he killed your ex-wife. I never got a good answer to that.
I guess not. We're almost out of time. I want to ask you about your take on one other person in the business. You write that Dan Rather got a bum rap.
I think he got a bum rap because I like Dan a lot, and I think he's a wonderful, involved journalist. And whether he's doing a hurricane or a city council meeting or he's in far-off places, he's the forerunner of Anderson Cooper, in a sense. Rather did what Cooper does so well, is on the scene, live broadcasting of events. And he covered a story about George Bush. And where I think he got a bum rap was when executives at CBS told me they believe he had it right. He just had a copy rather than the original of a statement.
About draft record.
Yeah, he ran where he served record. And what he served. Yeah. And so I think he got, in that case, a bum rap. And I will say this, why I admire Ted Turner so much. Ted would never have fired him. Never.
So we've been talking about you, your life, your times, your book. You once famously said that you don't read the books of authors you interview. Was that true?
Well, the problem was, and I believe most people don't, they sketch through them or a producer reads them. And that stems back to when I did the show you mentioned. I had 3 hours with a guest, an hour and a half to interview them, and then another hour and a half of phone calls. If I read the book, and I'm a vociferous reader, I'm reading all the time, I would feel a step ahead of the audience. So therefore, I knew more. So I didn't help you sell your book because I knew too much. My theory was to not know too much. So therefore, sometimes I'd hear someone say, in interviewing an author, on page 73, you said, well, I haven't read 72 and 71. So I never wanted to be ahead of my audience. The New Yorker did a story about me once. They call it street talk. And that's what I always felt I was. I'm a why guy. Why'd you write the book? And I was as interested in the author as I was the book.
But if I didn't read your book, I wouldn't have known that you thought Dan Rather got a bum rap or that you bounced to Spalding instead of going to your father's
Correct.
Funeral.
You know those things, and they work well for you. But you work to your pleasure. I would not have maybe found – but I might have found that out in 3 hours. Now, the shorter time you have – the more you have to read a book or get information about the book.
Larry King, and his new book is called Truth Be Told, off the record about favorite guests, memorable moments, funniest jokes, and a half century of asking questions. Thank you so much.
Mr. Larry, may I say, it's a delight talking with you. You're very, very good. You've been doing this a while.
Just a few years, and thank you. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and happy Boxing Day, everyone.